Shalom and welcome to another segment of Jewish Soul Music. This particular hour, I'll be presenting to you the background of a new segment that I am adding to my weekly program. It has to do with Yiddish and Henry Sapoznik. Henry, as you will hear, was instrumental with producing a 15-segment concerning 15 hours of segments of a Jewish, a Yiddish radio project. And this hour, we will hear a brief interview with Henry, and we will hear the first edition of the Yiddish radio project. And my goal is to present all 15 of them. And then, as you will hear, Henry Sapoznik has 1,500 hours of Yiddish radio programming. And I hope that it will work out that after we hear the 15 segments, Henry will be able to share with us on a weekly basis or on any basis that he so chooses to present these lost treasures. Well, they're not lost. They are treasures. So this is just a little bit of a background. Let's go to that interview that I had with Henry, and then the first edition of the Yiddish Radio Project. I'm very pleased to have with me on the phone, and my audience will forgive me for my issues with recording, and I am thankful that Henry Sapoznik is bearing with me. I'm so pleased to have Henry Sapoznik on the phone to discuss a very, very exciting program that we'll be instituting on my website. It has to do with the Yiddish radio project. But before we get to discuss that, first, let's say hello to Henry and get a little bit of his background. Shalom, Henry.
Hi, Charlie.
I know that many of my listeners are familiar with the name Sapoznik, but why don't you tell us a bit of your background in terms of Jewish music?
Well, some of your listeners might be familiar with my late father, Zindel Sapoznik, who was called the last of the Rovno Chazonim. He was the last of the cantors from the city of Rovno, which in Poland, when my father was growing up, was considered the city of Chazonim. It was the name Zadel Rovno might be familiar. My father grew up singing under Dovid Kusevitsky, and when Moshe Kusevitsky was the chazan in the Kreis HaShiel in Rovno, sang with Gershon Sirota when he toured Poland in the 1930s. So it was the last gasp of the great Chazonim. So when my parents came to the United States in 1949, my father continued singing. He was a chazan to his last days, and a great natural voice, beautiful falsetto. After he passed, I found some recordings that he had made in Linz, Austria, in the DP camp where he was, and I issued one of them. I did a reissue of Chazonish 78, probably 1990.
Uh-huh.
It was on there. But I grew up in this very kind of folksmensch religious household. My father obviously was. We had to move. I thought it was normal. Every 6 years, when he had a new contract with another shul, we had to move
uh-huh.
to the neighborhood. So I just thought, Now, I understood what the wandering Jews meant.
By the way, Yiddish was your primary language in the home?
Yeah, Yiddish was, I'm told that when I was a kid, my English sounded like I was a 45-year-old immigrant. My English, because I was learning from Holocaust survivors. That was, and I was in yeshiva. I was in Lubavitch and then Chaim Berlin. And all those kids were the children of survivors. Mm-hmm. So it's not like, you know, I thought everyone in the world, you know, was like that. So I grew up in a very traditional household. And my father, when at the age of six, as he had been, I was obliged to sing in choirs. At that time, in the 50s and 60s, it was regular for a chazan to have a choir, or as they called them, double choirs.
Uh-huh.
And I was, that was it, my whole year, between Shabbos and then preparing for going to hotels for Shavuos and for Pesach. I didn't have a Pesach in my own home until I was in my mid-20s. I didn't know what a Pesach Seder was. To me, a Pesach Seder was an intimate gathering of my father and my mother and me and 700 guests at the Normandy Hotel in Lochshelburg.
Wow. By the way, when did you pick up playing instruments, and what were the instruments that you played?
When my father let me out when I turned 13, he made me stop singing because he didn't want my voice affected. Give it a rest, and I took that as an excuse to escape singing choirs. And I got, this was at the height of the anti-war movement in the 60s. So a lot of folk music. So like everyone else, I learned to play the guitar and the banjo and listen to folk music like Pete Seeger and Woody Guthrie. And these were my new rabbonim. This was, so I got very into American folk music, American country music, and then started earning my living as a country musician. I toured, I don't know how many times we toured around Europe, the United States, playing traditional American country music, and played banjo and I sang.
It wasn't klezmer, though.
No, I wasn't playing any Jewish music. It was all traditional Southern country music. It was then in the late 80s, that I got interested in Yiddish music and started. It's actually earlier in the 70s that I first started getting interested about klezmer music and listening to collecting the klezmer records that were made on 78s in the 20s and 30s, and started playing klezmer music, and it had an effect. We had one of the first klezmer bands playing. I was lucky that when I got interested in the music, I had access to some of the great players. My father was friends with Dave Tarras because they knew each other from the Majestic Hotel, the Greatest Hotel. It was another one that they both worked at. So I grew up singing in my father's choir. If it was like Pesach, he'd sing for Yontif in the choir. And then at night, Dave Tarras would lead the band in the nightclub. So it was like, so I knew Dave and Pete Sokolow, who sang in my father's choirs toward the end when my father was at the Marine Park Jewish Center. And Pete Sokolow, who is an amazing gift. We are unbelievably lucky to have Pete Sokolow as part of the Jewish music community, because he is major, major talent. And so he was, we got involved. We started an orchestra together. We did a lot of concerts. We wrote together. We did records. Pete's a real, it was great. So the klezmer thing became a big worldwide movement, and I was, at this time, I was collecting 78s. I did a bunch of reissues. I did about 10 or 15 reissues of klezmer recordings, Yiddish theater, Chazunis, all of these great historic recordings. And young, I'll tell you, it always struck me as odd, and I still don't understand it, why the old recordings, the old klezmer recordings, triggered a worldwide movement for people to play klezmer music, but the Chazunis recordings did not do the same thing.
I think the instrumentalization had a better chance of being universal than hearing the strange language of Hebrew.
That could be, but you know, a lot of people are happy to sing Yiddish songs, and it makes it sound like it's a no known language. It's just weird in the Jewish world why. And this is a separate thing for me, having grown up in a Chazunis household, and all of the talk was about Chazunim, and all of our friends were, so that it's not something, all these great universities and Jewish theological seminary and wherever, and they don't honor this amazing gift that we had as, but I still collected these records, and I wanted to get them out. I thought people would be moved by them, and of course they were. And in about the middle 80s, I got interested in Yiddish radio, starting to, by accident, discover old broadcast records. They were not like the commercial records, the Columbias, the Victors, those things were pressed and stamped out 1,000, 2,000 at a time. If any Yiddish broadcast survived, because they weren't recorded, radio was all live then. So if a copy of a broadcast survived, it was one copy. It was one copy. And so finding anything, I ended up saving about 1,500 broadcast discs.
Where are they stored?
My collection, the broadcasts and the interviews and the photographs and the scripts and the posters, the whole gedila is at the American Folklife Center at the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C.
Fantastic.
Yeah, I'm very honored that the major American archives felt that the collection was unique enough, and there is no other collection of ethnic or minority radio in America that is as extensive and as the Yiddish radio collection, not the least of which that over a course of 7 years, starting in 1985, and then 1995, we started working on a documentary series about American Yiddish radio, and it aired on National Public Radio on a show called All Things Considered. Aired in the fall of 2002, and over 15 weeks, we had regularly 13 million listeners who were listening 1 week a show about a Yiddish a radio based in, and another week about Yiddish commercials, and another week about dramas, and about, it was like continuing saga. People tuned in, and mostly not Jewish, and they were moved by the power. When people think about radio from the 1930s, they do not think about this kind of stuff. They think about Jack Benny. They think about the Lone Ranger. They think about, you know, gangbusters.
Right. But it staggers the mind that 13 million people were exposed to this. It's awesome. It's awesome.
It was incredible. It was incredible to reach. And I think that's part of the reason why it won a Peabody Award, because it really exposed people to a parallel universe that no one knew existed. I mean, even the people who loved it the most, even the people who took part in it, never thought anyone would take an interest in this stuff. So having found the old records and having interviewed the survivors and their children and digging in, I jumped into more dumpsters to take out more thrown-out stuff.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh. You've never done anything like this, Charlie. I could tell. You're much more well-mannered.
Yes.
You know.
I'd kill for that one record I don't have. You know that.
I know. We don't have to explain this to each other. I'm with your very generous invitation. What we're going to do over the course of the next couple of months is to play as it was on NPR. We're going to play a chapter a week. Uh-huh. of this series. And if your listeners are interested, or if there's a good response when we finish, I'll be happy to dig into my collection and pull out some stuff and share little jewels from the collection. Share another sound of Jewish audio art.
I am so excited, Henry. You have no idea. First of all, the Yiddish world, I was not raised with Yiddish, although my bubby lived in the same home. It was a two-family house, and she only spoke Yiddish. I understood her, but she understood English, and I understood her Yiddish. But that's about it. And my bar mitzvah when I was 13, that's 1949. I gave my bar mitzvah speech in Yiddish, but I didn't quite know what I was saying.
Yeah, you were told say this. Yeah, make Semitic sounds. In my household, there's a lot of people I know who say, "Oh, my parents always spoke Yiddish when they didn't want me to understand what they were saying." Well, that was clearly not my household. We spoke Yiddish all the time. If my parents didn't want me to understand something, they would switch to Russian or, gotcha, or Polish. That I never learned.
Well, it's my desire. We're going to see the reception, which I am sure will be wonderful, and we'll see where we go from there. I'm looking to have this as a regular third or fourth hour on my program, and of course, I will be waiting for the feedback, which I'm sure will be positive. And I am so grateful to you, Henry, for first of all taking the time. I had a little problem in recording this, and I'm personally upset, and I'm very grateful that you stuck it out with me. I thought you were going to say,
who needs
to deal with this guy that doesn't even know how to record? But we have conquered that, and it's going to be wonderful.
Well, looking forward, enjoy this first episode of the series, and we'll talk again.
Okay, thank you so much.
Welcome to the Yiddish Radio Project. I'm Scott Simon.
WEVD, New York.
WLPA, Brooklyn, New York.
WCNW, operating on a frequency of 1500 kilocycles.
It all began one day in 1985, when musician and social historian Henry Sapoznik literally tripped over some ancient records in a dusty and cluttered storage room in New York City. They were transcriptions of old radio programs, extra-large aluminum discs made at the time of broadcast. On the faded labels, Sapoznik could make out station call letters, Hebrew writing, and program titles. He paid just a few dollars for the records, searched for the right contraption on which to play them, and then he sat down to listen.
From atop the Lowell State Theater building, your American Jewish Hour. The B. Manischewitz Company, world's largest matzah bakers, happily present Yiddish Melodies in Swing.
This was Yiddish radio, programs produced by and about the Jewish immigrants from Eastern Europe who came to America at the turn of the last century and settled in the Bronx, Brooklyn, and on the Lower East Side of Manhattan.
And now Maestro Sam Medoff and the lads of the Yiddish Swing Tet bring us the rollicking rhythms of Dayenu.
Henry Sapoznik spent the next 17 years scouring the country for more of these recordings. He's rescued more than 1,000 discs in all, over 500 hours of material, and he has collaborated with producers Dave Isay and Yair Reiner to create this series. The programs you'll be hearing are in both English and Yiddish, but the themes are universal. These recordings allow us to go back in time to eavesdrop on a lost world. We begin our tour with a history of Yiddish radio and this project from Henry Sapoznik.
I'm Henry Sapoznik, and this is my mother.
Hello, Henry.
My mother was born in Poland and was 21 when the Nazis invaded.
It's a long story, but thank God we survived and we came to America in 1949. My father had a sister. She took us to her house, but it wasn't the same. We wanted to be on our own. So one day, my husband got dressed up, and he walks. He looks around. A man comes, and he looks like a Jewish man. So he stops him. He said, "We just came to America. I have a wife and a child, and we need an apartment." He looked him over, said, "Come with me." And he showed him, "This is an apartment for you. You want, you can have it." And we moved in. But the first thing my husband bought was a radio. A white radio, plugged in the radio. I hear they speak Yiddish.
Very nice.
That was my life.
Very nice.
Everything is meant to be right.
She's always right. I grew up in Brooklyn in the late 50s and early 60s when almost everyone seemed to have turned their back on Yiddish. Nothing could be less cool, especially to a music-obsessed kid like me. When I was in my teens, I got into old-time mountain music. And pretty soon, I trekked down to Appalachia to learn from the masters. I was living with and studying fiddle and banjo music of North Carolina with this great old fiddle player named Tommy Jarrell. And Tommy was puzzled that a lot of the people who came down to study music were Jewish. And he said to me one day, he said, "Hank, don't your people got none of your own music?" And it got me thinking, yeah, maybe there are the Yiddish equivalents of Tommy Jarrell. And I found out that there were. I started to collect klezmer, that's traditional Yiddish dance music, on old 78 RPM records. And I set up the first ever Yiddish sound archives at the YIVO Institute, the world's biggest Yiddish research center. It's based here in New York. The word got out. People would bring these records like they were abandoned children, and this was like some orphanage that they said, "Oh, this is where they're going to take care of these things." So I would just tell them, yeah, bring me more. Pretty soon there was a whole klezmer revival, and there were hundreds of klezmer bands across the country playing this music. It was amazing. A couple of years later, I discovered my first stack of radio discs, and it changed my life.
How many suits do we have?
There's nothing.
Here we are in the epicenter of sound. This is Andy Lancet's lab where the preservation of the Yiddish radio discs happens.
Why?
This is the disc. You get a sense. It's made out of aluminum.
This particular disc
came out of a dumpster in Lower Manhattan. Obviously, it didn't weather very well.
For the past 10 years, Andy Lancet's been working his magic restoring these things.
They're generally referred to as acetates. I mean, to be more precise, it's castor oil plasticized nitrocellulose lacquer. But what happens is that the
acetates were not meant for repeated plays, unlike commercial discs. They were very delicate and were meant to keep a record of the shows that were on the air in case a complaint was made by a listener, and then the Federal Radio Commission, later the Federal Communications Commission, could hear it.
And in English. And in English.
Having collected old 78 records for years, I was used to a kind of rehearsed perfection. But putting on these radio shows, they were just real.
Williamsburg, Brooklyn.
Here was something that was completely unself-conscious. Everything was take one. It's like a transmission from another planet, and it's taken light years to get to us.
Their telephone, triangle 52729.
It's like you're back in 1940, sitting there with this old man listening to the radio in his bathrobe.
Schmaltz herring, homemade pickled herring, herring fillet in wine sauce, pickles, Zauerkraut. Mayonnaise, applesauce, apple juice.
So this is where it started. We're here on the Lower East Side of Manhattan on Christie and Delancey. Back in 1926, this wasn't the park that it is now. It was the site of the Libby Hotel, home of the first Yiddish radio broadcast, the Libby Hotel program.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. You are now tuned in.
And within months, there were Yiddish radio shows on small power stations throughout the New York area. On stations like WBBC, the Brooklyn Broadcasting Company.
WBBC, Brooklyn, New York.
WARD.
This is Ward, WARD.
WVFW.
You are now tuned in to station WVFW, the radio voice of the veterans of foreign wars.
They were going to lose their license, and I think they changed the letters so that they could seem more patriotic. Most of these were infinitesimal. They were tiny, tiny stations. You could only hear them from within the neighborhood they were broadcasting from.
WCNW, operating on a frequency of 1,500 kilocycles.
WCNW had like 50 watts of power. You couldn't even hear it in the studio. But the most famous Yiddish station of all was WEVD. Probably the first listener-supported station in history. It was created in 1926 by the Socialist Party to honor their recently deceased leader, Eugene Victor Debs. And it was taken over in 1932 by the Forward, the Yiddish socialist paper in New York. WEVD was home to the most renowned Yiddish show of all time, the Forward Hour, a lavish variety show that featured everything from extravagant musical numbers to the news performed in rhyme. Everyone listened. Everyone. Ironically, even though we have found hours and hours of some totally obscure Yiddish radio programs that no one ever heard of, only a couple of minutes of the old Forward Hour exist. One of the very few shards that survives is the show's closing theme song, a medley of revolutionary anthems from the Internationale to the Marseillaise. And that's just about all we've got.
The Forward Hour comes to you next Sunday morning at 11 o'clock. WEVD, New York.
Sloan's Liniment, your faithful friend when muscles ache and pain, presents Gangbusters.
Mainstream radio was about escapism. You turn on the radio and you would have The Lone Ranger or Gangbusters. You would have these shows that were exotic and escapist with these, like, really larger-than-life characters.
I own silver! Hi!
Yiddish radio, no one was larger than life. Everyone was life. It was a one-to-one ratio between the listener and the characters on the radio.
How's Mama?
Don't bother her. She has a headache.
I won't bother her. I'll only say hello.
They wanted a mirror. They didn't want a window to look out into another world. They wanted a mirror to see their own world.
I met Shirley, Phil's sister. They arrested him too, and she says they're going to send him to reform school.
If you were a listener to Yiddish radio, and you turned your radio dial a quarter inch to the left or a quarter inch to the right, you would have experienced a completely different universe.
much noise, Papala, so early in the morning.
Early in the morning?
Jews who were portrayed on mainstream radio were totally, totally different than anything people would have encountered in their real lives. You had characters like Mrs. Pansy Nussbaum on the Fred Allen Show.
No?
Oh, Mrs. Nussbaum.
You were expecting maybe Emperor Shapiro Hito?
Mr. Kitzel on Jack Benny.
Say, Mr. Kitzel, what are you getting your wife for Christmas?
I got it already here in this box. It's a beautiful fur coat.
What is it, the fox or sable?
On the label, it's sable. In the box, it's fox.
There were a few exceptions, like the Goldbergs.
That's Molly Goldberg, folks.
A show written by a woman named Gertrude Berg who wanted to portray her own life.
You're ready, darling?
Does Mikey know?
You don't know. How could you know, Jake?
But for the most part, it was all stereotypes.
Well, Mary, isn't it good to see Schlepperman again? Huh?
Yeah, but I wish he'd take that herring out of his hand while he's broadcasting.
And now, ladies and gentlemen.
It's Yiddish swing time. It's always springtime. Every Sunday at 1.
The golden age of Yiddish radio lasted from the 1930s to the 1950s. The people who created these magnificent programs, some of the best and most daring radio ever broadcast, have been largely completely forgotten. Like C. Israel Lutsky, the combative, obnoxious radio host who was the first advice columnist of the air. Carl Reiner does the voiceover.
You, my dear friend, with your own blind monkey love, are responsible for your own son's situation. If you want,
and there was Nuchum Stutchkoff, the brilliant linguist who wrote some of the finest dramas ever on radio. Here, he introduces one of his own plays. Stutchkoff is portrayed by Eli Wallach.
We bring you a new episode of Round the Family Table, an episode which takes place in New York but could have happened anywhere, in Philadelphia, Chicago, or anywhere where Jews live. The scene.
We've rescued goofy material like tons and tons of commercials.
Long and Island singing, Zolstein is clinging, it's Eastside Gluckstein's restaurant and caterers.
And serious programs like Reunion, where Holocaust survivors were reunited on the air.
And all this time, you haven't seen your father.
No, sir.
We want you to turn around, see if you know him. Ladies and gentlemen, that's really a touching scene. The father and son got each other in their arms. Tears of joy are going down their cheeks. And believe me, gentlemen, and ladies that are listening to me now, I have never seen such a touching scene in all my life. Ladies and gentlemen, they stand together there in each other's arms, and the emotion of the moment is really too much for them.
Yiddish radio and Yiddish culture went into a free fall after World War II. Almost all of the Yiddish speakers in Europe were murdered during the Holocaust. And when it was formed in 1948, the State of Israel turned its back on Yiddish in favor of Hebrew. In the United States, Yiddish radio fell victim to the successful assimilation of Jews into American culture and the rise of television. But there were a few holdouts, like Ben Gehling in Boston.
Ladies and gentlemen.
The earliest surviving recording of a Yiddish program we have is his from 1933, and he stayed on the air until 1999 when he died at the age of 100, making him the longest-running host in radio history.
If you wish to fill up your belly with gourmet food and the best of deli.
Ben Gehling loved to tell the story of his favorite guest, a violinist named Percy Brand, who came on his show shortly after he was released from Buchenwald.
I began interviewing him. He cried and I cried. And I said, well, let your fiddle talk. And it spoke to the hearts of people then, and even now after his death, Percy Brand, his name will never be forgotten.
Today, the last of the old-time East European native Yiddish speakers are dying off. For all intents and purposes, these recordings are our last visceral link back to a vibrant Yiddish culture.
No!
Mrs. Slefkovich! Get that whistle, Mrs. Slefkovich!
What's the matter, Mama?
I think part of the thing in Jewish life is you want a kaddishal. You want someone who's going to say the prayer for the dead for you after you're gone. And we're giving a kind of a kaddish. We're remembering these people, and we're honoring them, and we're keeping their names fresh and their memories alive.
Mrs. Levine.
My name is Mef Portnoy.
Mrs. Miriam Stein.
Zvi Hirsch Yosef Ben Rabbi Yankov Mendel Halevi Skula.
Their work still has great power. Their gift still has something to share with a whole new generation of listeners. And it melts away all of the intervening years.
Would you give her the $6 in
but
current
look, imagine
payments?
What's happening to my heart
just
all the
answer
time.
My question.
My mother's staying away for a year.
We,
she'll live around
you,
the corner.
We heard you. Would
listening
you
to these voices not only allows us to remember these people, but just for a brief moment allows them to be with us again, to be a part of us, to live again.
This concludes our Yiddish evening program for tonight. We leave here now to return again tomorrow afternoon at 1:30. Until then, good night